Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee meeting is called to order. Today is Friday, February 11th, 2022 at 1:33 in the afternoon. We're meeting in State Capitol Room number 205. Senators in attendance are Senator Keel, Senator Showers, Senator Hughes, and myself, Senator Holland. I believe Senator Myers has joined us via Zoom. So we do have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Nancy, our recording secretary, and Doug, our moderator for today. And as a reminder, please silence your cell phones. So the first item on today's calendar is Senate Bill 23 relating to initiative severability. We'll now bring Senate Bill 23 back before the committee. This is the third hearing on Senate Bill 23, though it was previously heard on April 19, 2021, February 9, 2022. So I'm going to open up for public testimony. Public testimony is now open on Senate Bill 23. Does anyone in the room wish to provide public testimony? I don't see anyone. Anyone online? Let me take a look and see. I guess we have at least, it looks like, two online, if I'm reading this correctly. And I'll first go to Katie Capozzi. Katie Capozzi, if you can hear me, please state your name, your affiliation. A new thing we're doing here is when you call in or Zoom in, we ask you to tell us your location and then provide your testimony. We'll try to keep it to about 2 or 3 minutes. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Katie Capozzi, and I serve as the president and CEO of the Alaska Chamber, and I am based in Anchorage. The Alaska Chamber was founded in 1953, and our mission is to promote a healthy business environment in Alaska. The Chamber has more than 700 members and represents businesses of all sizes and sectors from across the state. The Chamber supports passage of Senate Bill 23. Each year, our membership weighs in and votes on our advocacy agenda for the upcoming year. Support for ballot measure reform was recently added as an issue for statewide importance for the business community in Alaska. Our position of support for ballot measure reform states, in part, that, quote, changes in the initiative process should produce more transparency and better public policy in a comprehensive and balanced manner, equally benefiting both voters and the legislative process, end quote. To that end, the Alaska Chamber would like to focus our comments today on 2 points. First, transparency that will benefit Alaskans as well as ballot measure proponents, and second, upholding the constitutional rights and duty of the legislature. Once an Alaskan signs their name to specific ballot measure language, their support should be applied only to the exact language to which they lent their name. If any court or courts decides to alter or remove language from the initiative, it cannot and should not be assumed that support remains for the revised language. Likewise, should a court or courts sever language from a proposed ballot measure, it cannot and should not be assumed that the ballot measure proponents themselves will support the new language. Our current system threatens all ballot measure proponents, regardless of cause or political affiliation, as it restricts groups from being given the chance to go back to the drawing board if a court or courts alters the language of the measure they originally submitted. The second point is ensuring the constitutional obligations of the legislature are upheld. By allowing courts to sever language of a proposed law and placing that proposed law on the ballot, it is granting the judicial branch the power to write law, which is expressly limited to the legislative branch or to the people by way of the ballot measure process. This strips the legislature of its constitutional obligation to review initiatives and, should they choose, to enact a law that is considered substantially similar. In closing, the Chamber membership expresses our support for passage of SB 23, as it would benefit the people of Alaska and ballot measure proponents by increasing transparency and providing for a clear set of rules, as well as keep the express limitation of law writing to the legislature and to the people. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Capozzi, for your testimony. Next up will be Rebecca Logan. Rebecca Logan, if you can hear me, please state your name, your affiliation, and your location, and begin your 2 to 3 minutes.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Rebecca Logan. I am the CEO of the Alaska Support Industry Alliance, and we have locations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Kenai. We are a 43-year-old trade association with 500 members, and we represent the support companies for oil, gas, and mining in the state of Alaska. I appreciate the opportunity today to testify in support of SB 23. The Alliance has supported this legislation since the beginning when it was first introduced by Senator Burgess, SB 80. The Alliance believes that the provisions of an initiative should not be severable after being circulated. And our belief is based on our desire to protect the integrity of the ballot initiative process by making sure that voters know that the language on the ballot is exactly the same as what was presented to them for signature support. Also, our desire to prohibit the ability of a court and unelected judges to amend initiative language, thereby crafting legislation from the bench. And finally, our desire to ensure that ballot initiative language passes legal and constitutional muster before it's ever presented to the voters. I appreciate the opportunity again to state our support for SB 23, and I would ask you all to support this critical legislation. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, Rebecca Logan. Next up is Laura Bonner. Laura Bonner, if you can hear me, please state your name, your affiliation, and your location.
Hi, my name's Laura Bonner, and I live in Senator Rebeck's district, the same district that the late Senator Birch represented. And I oppose Senate Bill 23. The last Constitution, Article 11, Section 1, begins with, "The people may propose and enact laws by initiative, et cetera, et cetera." I think Senate Bill 23 would usurp people's power in the initiative process. The gathering of signatures demands a great deal of time and effort and expense to obtain the number of signatures required in all 40 House districts. If Senate bill is passed, the gathering of signatures would have to start all over. If one word, sentence, etc. was changed, added or deleted after judicial review or court decision. I have signed quite a few petitions over the years. And some of those I've signed only because I thought it should be voted on by the people or passed by the legislature before the election, as allowed in Section 4. And in the legal letter, the letter from Ledge Legal, dated April 23rd, 2019, regarding Senate Bill 80, which is identical to SB 23. There is paragraph at the end of that letter regarding the court has also described the people's initiative power as an act of direct democracy guaranteed by the Constitution. And if under Senate Bill 80, a person proposing an initiative would be prohibited from including the severability provision. It, because of that, it could be considered unconstitutional, and I really believe that. The voters' initiative constitutional rights shouldn't be stifled, and passage of Senate Bill 23 would do just that. And I'm not an attorney, but I think that there may be constitutional issues regarding the bill. As a 47-year resident and voter, I oppose Senate Bill 23. Thank you for your time and all that you do.
Thank you, Laura Bonner. Appreciate the timeliness of all the people who called in. Most of the comments are like two and a half minutes.
May I ask a question of her? And it doesn't have to be answered on the – I would ask her if she could
say I do like public testimony, just to put it forward. I mean, but I'll Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And this is for Laura. Do you don't have to respond, Laura, if you're still listening. I was just hoping that maybe you could send – some of your ideas to some of the committee members, because the question that this raises, if it is significantly changed from what people signed initially, and that was part of the problem why I kind of agree with the process, is they are no longer voting on an initiative that's what they originally signed up to. If it gets changed significantly, if you have ideas on how to amend that or amend this bill, I would be open to listening to those, because that has been one of the biggest arguments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Could I respond to his?
Sure, Ms. Bonner. Once again, state your name, just for the record.
My name is Laura Bonner, and I'm retired. Through the chair, Senator Showers, I think that where it really matters is when it gets to the ballot. Just as when you are going through the legislative process, there are changes. I've seen legislators support, co-sponsor a bill and then not vote on it or vote no against it on the floor as it changed. It's the floor vote for you guys that counts. It's when it's on the ballot that my vote counts. But thank you for asking that question.
All right. Thank you, Laura Bonner. And at this point, there's no one else for Senate Bill 23 public testimony. I'm going to close public testimony. Public testimony of Senate Bill 23 has been closed. Now I'll set Senate Bill 23 aside while we do work in the committee substitute. I will now bring Senate Bill 119 back in front of the committee. Senate Bill 119 is related to oaths of office. This is the third hearing on this bill, and Senate Judiciary was previously heard on January 31st. Public testimony was closed on February 2nd, 2022. I do have one amendment from my office. I move Amendment G2.
I will object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Amendment G2 simply removes references to the Declaration of Independence from the bill. I offer this amendment because, as fond as I am of the Declaration of Independence, it's my favorite Schoolhouse Rock. I think the only one I can sing from start to finish. State law requires public officials to swear an oath to the national and state constitutions. There is no reference to the Declaration of Independence in the oaths. As Senator Keel pointed out, expanding the list of required reading could open the door to any number of additional references that any one of us might feel is important in this instance. I think it's better policy to stick to a clear connection between the oath of office and the required reading this bill proposes. Do you maintain your objection?
Mr. Chair, I would like to perhaps have the bill sponsor discuss, if you wouldn't mind. Thoughts?
Senator, pardon me, I drew a blank. Senator Reinbold, welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee.
See your face.
Yeah. Please feel free to place yourself on the record. And
absolutely. Okay. Senator Laura Reinbold, District G. And through the chair, may I respond?
Please.
Okay. So, My opinion is, and it's actually been far greater than I, but one nation under God, we are to soar like an eagle, our United States, and we have the most longstanding constitution of any that I know, and it's been most powerful and protected of individual liberties. And the charter is the mission statement, which is the Declaration of Independence. That is our charter. That is our mission. And the Constitution is a set of bylaws that accompanies the Charter. That is what outlines due process and how the Charter is going to take place. The Charter and the bylaws, in my opinion, are inseparable. It's like two wings that allow the eagle to fly. And the reason why I think it's so important to have the Declaration in there is because a lot of people are yielding to the judicial branch for interpretation, and their supreme justices, and I'm not going to get into all of the times that they've been off mission, but when they say there's evolving standards around the Constitution, or if it's a living document, etc., what you go back to the charter, to the mission statement, and that makes it clear why we needed a mission statement and what our goals were, the pursuit of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and it protects individuals, and it keeps the judicial branch in their lane. So that's why I think it's inseparable. But Mr. Chairman, I understand you're the chair of the committee. So of course, I would absolutely object to the amendment. But I understand it's the will of the committee. So,
is there any further discussion on this amendment? Do you maintain your objection,
Mr. Chairman? Like you drew a blank before, I'm drawing a blank on words on a Friday afternoon. To support the sponsor of the bill and maintain it in an original form, because I could, and to quote a good friend of mine, I feel strongly both ways. I could go either direction on this. I'm going to go ahead and maintain the objection and let committee members vote as they see fit, of course.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Madam Secretary, comment from Senator Hughes.
Is it okay to have a discussion after a well, he's maintaining an objection, so we can continue to discuss. So I do think the tying it into the oath is important. I would hope that anyone who steps up to serve in any elected or appointed position in service of the people should be reading and familiar with the Declaration of Independence, but I do think, as this is the Judiciary Committee, and this is in the statute regarding the signing the oath, I think that connection is important. I think recommended reading of other things, or even, you know, I just don't think it fits right here because it's tied to the reading of the oath. We could add, as you mentioned, other items as well. So I'm a big fan of the Declaration of Independence. It's, and as the bill sponsors said, it is pretty fundamental. But I think just because these statutes are regarding the oath, and even the title of the bill is, the short title is Oath of Office, I'm going to stick with the readings tied to the actual oath itself.
All right. Thank you, Senator Hughes. I see Senator Myers has his smallish hand up. I thought his hands were bigger than that. But Senator Myers, if you can hear me, please state your name and your location, put yourself on the record, and offer some input.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Senator Myers. I'm currently in North Pole. I'm not quite sure how to take that comment on my hands. I kind of want to echo a little bit of what Senator Hughes said there about, you know, this bill is about what we're taking an oath to. And as important as the Declaration of Independence is, it's not what we take an oath to. And it, as Senator Reinbold points out, it's got a couple of pieces in there that do echo what we believe the purpose of government is, the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, of course, being the most well-known portion of that. But really, the vast majority of the Declaration of Independence is a list of grievances against England. And while that's important historically, I don't think that that's as important when it comes to the what we're taking an oath to. And if we're going to talk about other documents that pertain to the point of government, you know, we could start talking about John Locke's Second Treatise and things like that as well. So, again, Mr. Chair, kind of echoing what you said at the beginning with introducing this amendment, I think that removing it helps us narrow the focus down onto what it is that we take an oath to.
All right, Senator Myers, thank you so much for your input. Just to let anyone who's viewing know, as a senator not present, he can vote on amendments. He just cannot vote up or down on a bill. But all right, is there, with no other discussion, I will ask once again, do you want to maintain your objection?
I will maintain it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Madam Secretary, would you please care to call the roll?
Yes.
Senator Myers.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
4 yeas, 1 nay.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. With 4 yeas and 1 nay, Amendment G2 is adopted. Are there any further amendments? Seeing none, is there any further debate on this bill? Seeing none, Senator Reinbold, do you have any closing remarks on your bill?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's just vitally important for people to, especially in this day of age where the executive branch is on mission creep on all levels, from the local to the federal to the state, in addition to the judicial branch is trying to legislate often from the bench. I think it's of critical importance to understand that the Constitution was put in place to keep the government in its lane and to protect individual liberties. And with that, I'm hoping this bill makes out of committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Reinbold. At this time, I'll look to Senator Schauer for the will of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate Bill 119, Work Order 32-LS0163/G, as amended, be reported from the Senate Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
All right. With that, Senate Bill 119, Work Order 32-LS0163/G. Reported out of committee with individual recommendations and attached with fiscal notes. A short brief to sign the paperwork. Good afternoon. Senate Judiciary Committee is back on the record. At this point, I will bring... Yes. Senator Reinbold, thank you for being here. I believe we have another one of your bills up shortly. At this point, I'll bring Senate Bill 129 back for the committee. Senate Bill 129 is related to election pamphlets. This is the fifth and possibly the final hearing of Senate Bill 129 in the Senate Judiciary Committee. It's previously heard on May 5th in 2021, January 28th, February 2nd, and February 9th in 2022. Public testimony was closed on January 28th, 2022. We have two amendments to consider. And the first amendment is by Senator Hughes.
We take an at ease, please.
Brief at ease. Just getting all this paperwork in place. Senate Judiciary is back on the record. And so at this time, we have two amendments to consider. The first is by Senator Hughes.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move amendment number four, which is 0.5.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. I'll object for explanation. Senator Hughes, care to explain the amendment?
I hope your objection is only for explanation, Mr. Chair. I think it might be for something else, but that's okay. So what this bill would do is it would require a judge, whether it's their first time up for retention election or the second or third or fourth, for the information to be consistent. And the reason I believe – I have several reasons, Mr. Chair, why I think that is important, because I believe the more information a voter has, not less – is helpful to the voter. I also believe that we can fit on a page if we're expecting the first time someone is up, it to fit on the page. The second, third, and fourth time, the same information on the page will fit, and that's a consistency that will create less confusion for the voters. A voter could flip back and forth and wonder why certain information is being left off. So I think it reduces voter confusion. Thirdly, I think what shapes us stays true in our life. When you think about your childhood and how it shaped you, that is true whether you're 25 years old or 65 years old. So what shapes a judge in their pre-judge life is important information and true information, whether they're up for their first election or their second, third, or fourth. Those jobs and positions outside of the judiciary world, whether those were government positions or political positions, what area of law they've practiced, those kind of things are relevant, whether it's a first election or a second, third, or fourth. The other thing is, and my last point is, and I'm going to give the example of a Superior Court judge who is up every 6 years. And in a six-year period, Mr. Chair, nearly one-third, about 30% of the population are people new to the state. So if someone is not here 6 years ago, they wouldn't have seen that information. So now all of a sudden they're facing a decision about a judge, and if we don't include this, they won't have that background information. And to be perfectly honest, probably you and I aren't going to remember what was on that election pamphlet page 6 years ago. So for sake of all the new Alaskans, up to 30% every 6 years, and for the sake of our memories, which it's hard to remember what we read 6 years ago in an election pamphlet, I believe that all the information should be available to the voter every election, whether it's the first, second, third, or fourth. And that is the case I have to make.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. I see Senator Myers. Do you have a comment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I do appreciate the spirit in which the amendment is offered. I think it fits with the spirit of the bill. But my objection to the amendment here a little bit is more technical than anything else. We're talking about, as Senator Hughes mentioned, a little bit of limited space. And we're trying to provide the voters with not just information, but also what is most applicable. And I get worried about if we include things that are guaranteed to never change, because these are all things that happen prior to a person being selected as a judge, that I'm a little worried that we're going to lose space for some of the things that do change. So, for example, a description of the judicial legal or other education of the judge, that can change over the years as more continuing education classes are taken. Or alternately, a description of public disciplinary proceedings. We could have, you know, multiples of those over the years, potentially. And so I get a little worried when it comes to applicability. And as she stated, you know, that we could have this up for some judges in the pamphlet and not for others. And I would hope that that would prompt at least some of the voters to go, oh, some of this is missing. Where can I go find it, perhaps, and find it on the Judicial Council website? So while I understand the intent of the amendment here, I'm a little leery of including it.
All right, thank you, Senator Myers. Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I kind of like Senator Myers, the sponsor of the bill. I agree with Senator Hughes on the theory behind what she's trying to do here. My concern really, quite frankly, boils down to something much simpler, is that I see kind of what's taking place here, and having been at odds, I guess the best way to say it, with the judiciary at times and other bills and things that are taking place, my concern is that there will be a push to increase the amount of words required to do all of these things. And what I see out of that, Mr. Chairman, is right now there is a zero fiscal note. And I believe what will happen is there will be an effort to say that now there will be a fiscal note, because there is currently zero fiscal notes from, according to the sponsor. If that's the case, kind of like in hockey where penalties are, you know, sent to the box over there to die, I'm kind of afraid this goes to finance where it dies. And that's my personal experience currently with watching a bill go there and never get heard. And so I think that the current format of the bill gets the message across that people have more information available to them. I would be concerned about watching an effort to increase the size of that, which would drive a fiscal note, because then they will come back and say, well, we have to have more information on each pamphlet, bigger, you know, some more pages. It's going to cost money. And the experience has not been positive for me in the current environment trying to move bills that way. So I believe the original bill in its current format works, and while I agree with the sponsor of the amendment, this would be good. I think it has too good of a chance of actually maybe unraveling it or even causing it to die, and so for that reason, while it's a good idea, I think I can't support it because of what it might do. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Schauer, and I'll add my comments, just that I'm aligned up with Senator Schauer on this. I think that the Senate Bill 129 is a great improvement on the process, and amendment number 4.05 is not a bad idea, but I'm concerned about what the changes will cause. And so with that, I'm going to maintain my objection. And Madam Secretary.
May I make wrap-up comments, please?
Yes, Senator Hughes, please do.
Yeah, thank you. First of all, because the space concern and the cost concern, neither one of them are valid, Mr. Chair, because the bill sponsor mentioned space because we're adding additional things, but actually in the bill, the business experience and professional positions held in the preceding 10 years, because those are going to trim back as a person is serving as a judge, and they're not going to have things before they were judge in those 10 years, the business and professional things will fade off, and that will leave room for these items. And also, as far as there's absolutely nothing in this amendment that would trigger a fiscal note as compared to what is in the bill itself. So this is not going to all of a sudden say, if we amend this, oh, now we have to have a fiscal note, because this is information that is collected and the judge would provide. And when we sit down as candidates to fill out the form for the election pamphlet, whatever they ask for, if they ask for a little more information, as long as it's fitting on a page, and this is, we know this can fit on a page because it's happening the first round, there is nothing in this amendment is going to increase the cost. And there's going to be a trade-off as far as things that are going to drop off after the first election that won't be on the sheet. So there would be room to have this on the second. So as far as cost and space, I believe that those arguments don't stand. And so I'm going to support this. And I think more voter information is better than less information. And for the sake of new Alaskans and for those of us who you know, 6 or 12, 18 years might be able, not be able to remember. I think a big motivation of leaving this off is because the Judicial Council doesn't want earlier political and government affiliations as part of the information. I think that is important voter information to have throughout the judge's career. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. I am in support of. Pardon me, I'm maintaining my objection for my own personal reasons, not for any other organization. I'll just say that right now. But with that, I will maintain my objection. And Madam Secretary, if you please call the roll.
Senator Myers.
No.
Senator Keel.
No.
Senator Shower.
No.
Senator Hughes.
Yes.
Senator Hahn.
No. With a vote of one yeas and four nays, Amendment Number 4, 0.5, is not adopted. The other amendment is from my office. I move Conceptual Amendment 1, Conceptual Amendment 1, labeled Amendment 0.6 as amended. Mr. King, would you please explain the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Ed King.
Yep, I'm sorry, there's been no objection.
I object, Mr. Chairman, for a purpose of the discussion.
Mr. King, would you care to explain the amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, for the record, Ed King, Senator Holland. Mr. Chairman, this is the amendment that was introduced, was offered in the last hearing, debated, and withdrawn. The discussion around subparagraph F, the language in the current bill, there's discussion that the courts might not be able to provide that information. The Judicial Council provided some alternative language that was Amendment 0.6. There was concerns by the sponsor of the bill that the information that was in the amendment may be too voluminous, and requested that the second half of 0.6 be removed. So Conceptual Amendment Number 1, satisfies that intent. It's the first half of Amendment 0.6 from before, and I believe the sponsor and Ms. DiPietro could elaborate more on the consequences of such.
Thank you, Mr. King. Senator Myers, do you care to elaborate?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So as Mr. King noted, when we brought this amendment up initially a couple days ago, the first half of it, which is the part that's preserved here, I'm in favor of. I believe it's a decent technical clarification, and I don't have any objection to it. But the second half I did have an issue with, I was concerned about the amount of verbiage that might be used to explain and put different things into context. So removing that portion of it, I'm perfectly in favor of. Perhaps the Judicial Council and the Division of Elections could get together and maybe at the beginning of the judge section, maybe put in a half a page explaining the different ratings as they do currently, and maybe explaining a little bit of background with the appeals rates and the like. I'd be fine with that, but I didn't want to address that directly into statute. So I believe this is a good amendment.
Thank you, Senator Myers. I see Suzanne DiPietro online as invited testimony to speak on this amendment. Ms. DiPietro, do you care to offer anything?
Thank you, Chair Holland. This is Suzanne DiPietro. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council, and I just wanting to be here for questions if anyone had any, and I would just offer that the Judicial Council takes no position on actually either amendment.
All right. Well, thank you, Ms. DiPietro. Senator Hughes.
Yes, I have a question for Ms. DiPietro. The bill sponsor mentioned that perhaps the Judicial Council and the Division of Elections could get together and provide some explanatory material on a separate page that would apply to all the judge pages. Do you know if that is a possibility, or would that have to be required by statute?
Senator Hughes, through the chair, Suzanne DiPietro with the Judicial Council, I would have to talk to the division about that. I'm not fully aware of the constraints that the division may have on their pages or space. So certainly I can assure you that it would be something that the council would explore with the division.
And follow up?
Follow up from Senator Hughes.
And can you briefly tell us what disadvantage it might be to the voter who is reading, if this amendment is accepted, who would just read these numbers of decisions without some explanation somewhere in the pamphlet? How do you think that might mislead a voter or not mislead a voter?
Thank you, Senator Hughes, through the chair, Suzanne DiPietro with the Judicial Council again. The council always provides this information about the number of the percentage of decisions that were affirmed in context. So the way that the council currently provides that information, as posted on our website, is in a fairly lengthy memo. It's actually 10 or 11 pages, and it gives the percentages for all the judges standing for retention, but compares them to historical averages and to other judges, and not just the judges standing for retention, but to all the other judges, because that provides the context for the voters to understand the significance of the percentage, so that the voters can understand whether that judge's performance seems to be within the range of the performance of other judges that have similar caseloads, or whether it is lower or higher. So the council always has provided this information with a significant amount of context. And I would suggest that any context that we could provide working with the division within the word limit in the statute and the division's own logistical issues, we would try to insert context. That would be our preference, so that the voters can understand what the numbers mean. That's the bottom line for us.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Pietro. Thank you, Senator Hughes. That's it. All right, Senator Schauer.
This may be for Mr. Pietro, but it may not. I guess it is a quick question, Mr. Chair, for her. If currently, basically, a voter, which, as we already know, they get a lot of stuff thrown at them through the campaign cycle, and we always seem to say, well, we'll just educate them on ranked choice voting. It's easy, which we know it's not, going through hearings, or they can just go to an 11-page document and pull it out. It's easy. That's not the reality, nor time. That's just not reality. So this will take it and put it in front of them in a succinct form where they don't have to break it out and they can see it. Is that in fact the case, Mr. Chair? That's really what I'm asking. It goes from a big document to where they're going to be able to see it on them now, and that doesn't happen now. I don't remember. I'm just trying to get it on the record.
It might be a question for Senator Myers.
Could be. For the sponsor.
Yes. Senator Myers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as of right now, the appeals rates are not listed in the pamphlet. Effectively, the only thing coming from the Judicial Council at the moment is the surveys and the listing of the surveys and the ratings from jurors, law enforcement officers, et cetera. And so, again, kind of keeping with the spirit of the bill is we want to give out enough information, but at the same time not overwhelm the voters. So we did want to give out the appeals rate information, but we didn't want to either A, take up too much space, or B, overwhelm everybody with an explanation of how much significance to add to certain portions of it. So I would hope that most voters would be able to look at it and say, oh, we've got seven judges up for retention this time around. They've all got, you know, roughly the same appeals rate. You know, that's nothing to worry about. Or, oh, this one has an appeals rate that's affirmance rate that's 15% lower than most of the others, then we may have a problem here. So, while I understand Ms. DiPietro's point, at the same time, there is some context provided, and there's also some limits as to how much can be provided when we're trying to provide a little bit broader range of information.
Thank you, Senator Myers. A follow-up from Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I appreciate this because that's what I wanted on the record so that the public understands it. And I appreciate the work the Judicial Council does. They put a lot of work into the product, but citizens are not going to go dig into an 11 or 12 page document trying to pull this out. That's not the way the world works. So this effort to put it in front of them directly on a pamphlet they would see for the judges they would vote for retention makes a lot of sense to me. And this is part of being very transparent as a government in general for people to see the data. So I appreciate what's happening and this portion of it getting in front of the people. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Senator Schauer. Senator Hughes.
So I think we may be a little mixed up because by what we're doing here is we're taking out the explanation and we're just going to have a number of decisions and the percentage that were affirmed. Okay, so now we're going to have a number and a percentage. And what Ms. DiPietro is stating is that they may be able to put in the pamphlet, working with Division of Election, an explanation maybe on the page that the front page that leads to all the judges' pages. But she's not sure of that. So that's, first of all, I'd like to say I'd like to know that, because if you can do that without any statute, then great, we're good. If you can't and this bill moves out, we might want to consider that to add that on the floor, because I do think just as a number, I know the sponsor's trying to keep the space and keep clutter and keep it simple. But if I just see a number and a percentage, then I'd have to leaf back through all the other judges and kind of guesstimate whether it's in the range. So I actually would like a little explanation, because again, back to the, you know, making sure the voters have the information they need and an explanation so they can understand the significance of that number and percentage. I think that is important. So I guess I would say I'm comfortable with the amendment as it is right now, but I would like to know from Ms. DiPietro, after she talks to the Division of Elections, if they would have the flexibility to put in an explanation, and then perhaps every place where this is noted, there could be an asterisk, so the voter could go back to understand what those numbers, if they are in within a normal range or not. So I think we have some confusion because she's thinking maybe they can do it. We're taking it out off of each page. Senator Schauer kind of wants to not have to go through an 11-page document, but I think he wants to know what the number and the percentage signify, if I'm correct. So having said all that, I'm comfortable with the way it is, but I'm hoping she'll get back with us, and I hope this committee will consider a floor amendment if it's needed. And I'd be curious whether the bill sponsor disagrees or would agree with considering a
one question at a time, Senator Hughes. You have to stop talking before we can get an answer up.
Well, the question basically is
I know,
what I explained is
Ms. DiPietro, do you have a?
It's actually the question is for the sponsor. Once we get the information from Mr. Petro, would he be interested in making sure on the floor that
once we get the information from Mr. Petro, so we have to go to Mr. Petro first, correct?
Well, no, she already told us she talked to the Division of Elections. She doesn't know yet.
Okay. All right, so now we're going to Senator Myers. You've been able to follow us any better than me?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think so. I'd be interested in thinking about it. We do have one more committee ahead of this bill before it goes to the floor. So we would have a possibility of putting something there if we needed to. But I believe I don't think it's necessary. But I would like to hear what happens with the conversation between the Division of Elections and the Judicial Council as well.
And follow up because it goes to another.
Thank you, Senator Myers. Follow up, Senator Hughes.
I didn't realize it went to another committee, so that works for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Senator Schauer, did you have a comment? Nope. All right. So at this time, Senator Schauer, do you maintain your objection?
Can we take it out of ease real quick, Mr. Chair?
Brief at ease. Senate Judiciary is back on the record, and so once again, I'll go to Senator Schauer, who provided an objection for discussion. Senator Schauer, do you maintain your objection?
I remove my objection, Mr. Chair.
Is there any other objection from the committee? Seeing none, without objection, conceptual amendment number one, labeled 0.6, is adopted. Are there any further amendments? Seeing none, is there any further discussion or debate? Seeing none, Senator Myers, I'll go to you if you have any closing remarks on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll keep it brief. Just say again, thank you for all the work that's been done on this bill for the last, 9 months now that we're up to, I think. And again, the point of the bill is just a little bit of voter education. This is a point of our elections that often gets neglected. And I just want to make sure that people have a little bit of information going forward on who they're voting for. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Myers. At this time, I'll look to the will of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that Senate Bill 129, Work Order 32-LS0751/O, as amended, be reported from the Senate Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Without objection, Senate Bill 129, as amended, has been reported from the committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. A brief at ease to sign some paperwork. Judiciary. Senate Judiciary is back on the record. Senate Bill 118. So at this time, I'll bring Senate Bill 118 back before the committee. Senate Bill 118 is related to the nullification of federal laws. My intent is to take public testimony, resolve any remaining issues, and set the bill aside for further work. This is the second hearing on 118. We previously heard it on February 2nd. At this time, I'll open public testimony. Public testimony is now open on Senate Bill 118. And I see Mr. Mike Coons standing by. Mr. Coons, if you can hear me, please state your name, any affiliation, your location, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Senator Holland. This is Mike Coons. I'm speaking from myself, and I'm calling from Power. First off, Senator Reinbold, education is a serious form of flattery, since this nullification is the basis of the counterland amendment passed by the legislature. I read this bill. It gives the committee the duty to review statutes, regulations, executive orders, then to bring to the legislature to nullify those laws, regulations, or executive orders as needed. Will this take courage by the committee and legislature? Sure. But at least until the countermand amendment can pass, our state would have that ability. It is passed for the states who are fed up with overreach. This may pass similar and or pass a countermand amendment for a future constitutional convention or a congressional amendment within the Congress. So I fully support this Senate Bill 118.
Thank you, Mr. Coons. And that's all I believe I see waiting online to speak on 118. Is anyone in the room caring to offer a public testimony on 118? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. I think I was hearing a little bit of feedback there. All right, so public testimony is now closed. During the last hearing, members had several questions for follow-up. I have Megan Wallace standing by, and Megan Wallace, first of all, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This is Megan Wallace, the Legal Services Director.
Thank you so much. I'm just going to give you a few questions that came up previously on Senate Bill 118. And first, can you educate us on the interplay between federal and state laws?
Sure. Again, for the record, this is Megan Wallace, the Legal Services Director.
This would be in relation to the Supremacy Clause, and the interplay between federal and state laws.
Sure. The Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution, or the Federal Constitution, specifically states that the laws of the federal government shall be the supreme laws of the land. So the U.S. Constitution specifically states that states will follow federal law, and the 10th Amendment reserves to the state the power where there's an absence of federal law or regulation. So in other words, if the federal government and the state government pass laws that conflict, the Supremacy Clause provides that the federal law will trump the state law in that regard. But if the federal government has not regulated or have laws in a certain area, the 10th Amendment reserves for the states to go ahead and make laws related to those areas.
Thank you. There's going to be no grade on these answers. Here's a question. Are you aware of any legal precedent to support a state's right to nullify a federal law within its borders?
I am not aware of any case law that supports the proposition that the state or a state legislature has the power to nullify a federal law. From a general legal principle, the mechanism that is used to challenge federal laws is through litigation, and the, you know, Marbury versus Madison essentially established the, you know, the federal judicial doctrine that it's the federal courts and the United States Supreme Court that ultimately have the role and responsibility to decide whether or not federal laws are unconstitutional.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Schauer.
Just in case, because I know the question came up, perhaps the bill sponsor, she might have more fidelity on that, so I thought maybe she could add to it just in case.
Yeah, I didn't know if she has a turn and I get a turn or how this is working out.
Well, we'll invite the bill sponsor to the presenter's table, Senator Reinbold. Oh. And if you did you have some input on the last question?
Absolutely. Yes.
So the last question was, are you aware of a legal precedent for a to support a state's rights to nullify a federal law within its borders?
Okay. So first of all, I'm going to say there's three states that have set precedents in regards to this, and it's Wyoming. Just a second. I'm getting to my questions really quick. But I know Wyoming, Alabama, and there's a third state. Utah. So, yes, if I could expand, Mr. Chairman?
Please do.
I think that's why it's so doggone important for I really appreciate Senator Keel bringing up the Federalist Papers, even though I didn't put that in amendment. I sure wish he would have. But it's very, very important to know that the laws of Congress are restricted. The Constitution restricts the laws of Congress to create a certain sphere. When they depart from the sphere, they are no longer supreme and they are no longer binding. And Federalist 33, Hamilton noted that the clause expressly confines the supremacy clause made pursuant to the Constitution, so they have to stay in their lane.
Does the language in SB 118 match the language other states have passed into law?
I would have to have a review of Ledge Legal in regards to that.
Okay. And this question might have been answered, but so does the Alaska legislature have the authority to tell Alaskans not to abide by a federal law or executive order?
And is that directed to me?
For now.
The constitutions, and I was just rereading both of them again, are very, very protective of individual liberties. And if it is unconstitutional, a federal law is unconstitutional, it absolutely is in our duty to make sure that the individual liberties, we take an oath to that Constitution. We take an oath to defend individual liberties. And I think there's many cases right now, and I think the courts across the nation are proving that what the current administration is doing is violating the Constitution in case after case after case. So I do believe we could have been proactive. I wish we would have. This bill was here, you know, last year, and I just wish we would have been more authoritarian in regards to taking our due responsibilities as a state legislature to protect not only individual liberties, but state sovereignty. So I absolutely believe that it's our responsibility to do it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Schauer.
It's really to the last one with Megan Wallace's answer, but I wanted to throw this out here because I do think it's at least perhaps germane to the discussion. As Senator Reinbold knows, I support this effort and I support state rights because we are a federated system for a reason. So that, you know, as I've said before, what works in Alaska doesn't necessarily work in Florida, New York, Hawaii, Texas. We're all different cultures, different people and how they want to do business. And in response to this federal supremacy clause, why this matters to me, particularly when we talk about the founders of the nation and what they wrote when they wrote, I highly suspect they never saw the size and the growth of the federal government, but it'd be this overarching monolithic power that literally has made laws on everything we do to the point of where you have U.S. sitting senators and congressmen saying, well, we've all broken a law. We just haven't been charged with it yet. I mean, you're talking tens upon tens upon tens of thousands of pages of laws that usurp almost everything we do. So I only say that in a sense, Mr. Chairman, I think it is a valid effort to try to put the brakes on the federal government because of how big and powerful it has become and usurped so much power from the states. The states have let that happen. I myself have a bill that you're going to hear I believe, soon that talks about trying to bifurcate the election system in case we get that shoved, and to be quite frank, shoved down our throats that we don't want because we want to do it our way, not how a bureaucrat or an elected official in Washington, D.C. does. So from the generic discussion of this effort, I think it is important to note the context of history that when these documents were made and written, we didn't have this kind of federal government. We didn't have this kind of power grab that you can see that's so massive that affects everybody across 14 time zones, half the planet. So for what it's worth, Mr. Chairman, I just think we don't want to forget the historic context. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you. I want to make it clear that Article 6 that declares the federal law as the supreme land of the supreme law of the land is not in conflict with Article 10, which allows the states to retain power over anything that's not specifically granted to the federal government. So I think one of the things that we might want to strengthen in this bill, and it alludes to it, and I think the bill sponsor was trying to get it there, and that is on page 2. Let me find it. Starting on line 11, in making its recommendation, the committee shall consider whether the statute, regulation, or executive order is outside the scope of the powers delegated to the federal government in the Constitution of the United States. So I would say it is not constitutional to nullify something that is in the Constitution granted to the federal government to govern. But if it's an item that is not granted to the federal government and it falls under Article 10, then we should have the way to nullify it. Megan Wallace mentioned the normal way is through litigation to nullify something. Well, yeah, that was a precedent set. But that doesn't mean it's the only way. There's nothing that prohibits in the Constitution a state for putting a stake in the ground and saying, whoa, this violates Article 10. These are not powers granted to the federal government. Therefore, we as a state will not follow that because the Congress has enacted something outside their scope. So I think as long as we make sure we're not nullifying things just because we don't like them, or we wish the federal government hadn't passed this or that, as long as I think that we can, as a state, nullify something that falls within Article 10, Mr. Chair. So I'm just thinking we might want to strengthen that and actually put Article 10 in that section of the bill.
All right. Thank you, Senator Hughes. And I'm going to go back to Megan Wallace, if I could, just ask a few more questions. So is Alaska's legalization of marijuana an example of nullification?
Through the chair, again, for the record, this is Megan Wallace, the Legal Services Director. I don't think legalization of marijuana is nullification. It's my understanding that nullification is this term that is used in the context of this general legal theory that a state has the right to nullify or invalidate federal laws which the state deems to be unconstitutional. The state passing legislation that expressly allows for, or the state marijuana laws didn't nullify or attempt to invalidate the federal laws that continue to govern the regulation of marijuana. And as most of you are probably acutely aware of, that there is still this tension between state and federal governments with respect to marijuana. And while the federal government has not enforced the federal laws against marijuana in states that have legalized marijuana, that tension still exists, and there's always been a possibility that the federal government would enforce those laws in superiority of the state laws.
Thank you. I'll just say I did not believe that Alaska's legalization of marijuana was an example of nullification, but I was curious as to how we choose not to enforce that law. But if Alaska were to follow the process to nullify a federal law, what would happen if the federal government decided to enforce it? Did you have any input on that, Ms. Wallace?
With respect to the specific bill itself, I have some concerns in terms of the process that the state or the legislature would possibly use to nullify a federal law. The bill provides for nullification by concurrent resolution. We have Alaska Supreme Court decisions that indicate that if the legislature is going to act and it's going to affect people outside of the legislative branch, that it needs to act by law, which so arguably if the legislature was going to nullify anything, the bill risks challenge to the extent that the legislature doesn't do that by law. Secondly, if the legislature were to attempt to nullify a federal law, as you mentioned, the federal government, there's a strong likelihood that the federal government wouldn't recognize or believe that the state has the power to nullify that federal law and continue to execute or enforce it in Alaska. And it seems to me that ultimately that tension or conflict would end up in court.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Wallace. Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just going to wrap three things up real quick on this because you brought them up here, and I think they're important. And this is nothing at Megan Wallace. It's not necessarily true on the marijuana that they weren't enforcing it. And early on, they were in places, and this is where some court cases came through, because I was watching them to see what the feds would do versus states. It's less common now, I think, because it's becoming so common across the country that they're just kind of letting it go and they're not trying to enforce it. It's becoming too much of an issue. Plus, they're resource limited. And that's really the stretch here. It's not that some of them, like DEA, don't want to enforce it. They just don't have the resources. And they rely on the states and local authorities to do it. So it's not entirely true. But like I said, you'd have to really have paid attention to it that they were for a while. I think they've just kind of, quite frankly, given up. There is an option on, and you mentioned this, Mr. Chair, on what we could do versus the nullification process, and it does come down to those resources again, like I mentioned, bifurcating the election system. If they tried to say, Alaska, we're going to take over your elections, you go, okay, fine. You're going to have to create an entire federal system. You know, you're going to have the voters, the money, the machines, everything. Do it yourself. You're not using our stuff, and we're going to do it our way. And it makes it very hard for them to enact it because they have to create all of that extra system to do it, and that's the state saying, leave us alone. We're not going to help you, which goes back to we don't use state resources to help the federal government enact laws we believe to be unconstitutional. It is a way to push back that is both legal and within our rights to do so. They would just have to do it with their own resources, and that doesn't get into the conflict between constitutional powers, et cetera. So just throwing it out there, Mr. Chair, there's a number of things in play here, but some of these bills go down that path of saying, you know, fine, if you're going to do as federal government, do what you want, but we're not going to support you, all the way down to sheriffs, because sheriffs are the ones that actually enact the laws. In states, we have counties and, you know, state troopers, et cetera, so it's a little different, but that's how it works. And if they decide not to enforce it, feds have to do it themselves. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. That's pretty much exhausted my questions on this bill. Are there any other questions from the committee? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One question that I had posed to the sponsor staff in our last meeting, and be interested in hearing the sponsor's thoughts on, would just be the cost of this committee. I think when you average it out every year since World War II, Congress passes about 2 million words of new federal law. You're looking at 3,000 to 4,000 new federal regulations of I don't know how many words a piece published each year. What kind of public investment in this committee, which is to review each and every one of these, do you anticipate?
Okay, so through the chair, I used to be chairman of Admin Reg Review, and I think in hindsight is 2020 often, And I think combining the Administrative Reg Review Committee with this committee would probably be the appropriate move going forth. And, of course, we're not going to review every single one. That would be the order of priority to ones that are blatantly a violation of states' rights or individual liberties, which I think is of critical importance. And the Admin Reg Review, we had Terry Bannister. I worked with her for years. She did an excellent job. She was a half-time lawyer on this, and she would be the one that would raise questions and then bring them before me as chair of Administrative Reg Review Committee. And it was actually a phenomenal. It was a year round committee, and it was very, very helpful. So this really does mirror a lot of what we did in the past with the Administrative Regulatory Review Committee. And then we also made sure that the regulation that the state statute actually aligned with the intent of the state statute. So that would be the best answer. And I still would like to circle back around to a couple of the other issues that were brought up earlier when the Mr. Chairman allows me to. So
just to follow up, Mr.
All right.
So I guess the bill just says upon receipt of. Is it, Mr. Chairman, is it the sponsor's intention that those would all be reviewed and forwarded by Legislative Legal Services, or would they be citizens who forward them to the committee? Who would do the winnowing so we didn't review everyone?
Senator Reinbold?
Through the chair, I was allowing the committee to set up the process for that. That's why in the bill it strictly says that the committee will be helping, you know, set up a process like that. So it would be open to whether the Ledge Legal did it or a member of the, you know, or anybody out in the public, you know, that would bring it to, let's say your constituent brought it to you and you could bring it forth if you were on the committee, or there would be a process set up, and that's what the committee does.
I'll wait.
And I see Senator Myers has his hand up. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I was hoping to kind of run through just a little bit of a practical exercise, talk about an issue that has come up in the legislature over the last dozen years or so a couple of times to see how this would play out. My thought is the Real ID Act from 2005. At one point, we had a statute passed saying that we weren't going to expend any state resources to implement the Real ID Act, and I believe that got repealed a couple of years ago. My initial question for Senator Reinbold, is this something that you would envision as a candidate for nullification?
Through the chair?
Through the chair.
Through the chair, yes, because in the state constitution, Article 1, Section 22 said privacy of the people shall not be infringed, and it's the legislature's responsibility. So I would say yes.
Okay.
Senator Myers.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. So going along with that, let's say that this committee reviewed that, decided that they wanted to nullify it. Let's say the legislature voted on it, whether that was through concurrent resolution or a bill, whatever. How would that play out in the public? If I, for example, it's my understanding that one of the reasons it got pulled, that we were going to go ahead and expend funds to implement the Real ID Act, was because a number of businesses were concerned about their people being able to access military bases. So if the state nullified that law, and then I, as a contractor, showed up at a military base and tried to submit my non-Real ID compliant driver's license to get on base, and they rejected it, what would happen?
And through the chair, when I was just refreshing myself on the Constitution, the federal lands and the federal law often, you know, it, especially when it comes to DOD and things like that, that is, they're under a bit of a different jurisdiction. So that is a more complicated issue, but the DOD does have specific rules. But I know when I was getting on base, they allowed me to use my passport, which was completely, so they often provide the least restrictive And so the passport is working just fine. So
Senator Schauer wants to have a little input on this.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I can just answer this from 24 years of doing that. And you're not, I mean, that's correct that they have they follow federal institutions, what they claim is their land, if you will. They can absolutely enforce those things because you have national security, other things that fall under that bailiwick, and that's fine. But there is a process for that. So what you would see in the case of, it's a good question, is you would go up and go, okay, let me see your ID. You don't have a military ID. You don't have a real ID on here, so we're going to set something up. And what they would do is they would give a contractor, they would have a – I've done this before. This is from personal experience, and they will go through a list, and they will get your name, social security number, said whatever you need for identifiers. They will come back. They will vet it, and then they will stamp approval on it, and you will get a temporary pass to get on base to do your job. Or they're not going to let just anybody come on and do that, but if you're a contractor for events or things that happen, they do this all the time. So there are processes and procedures for doing those things that in this particular question or vein would not prevent business from taking place, if that makes sense.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Senator Myers, do you have any more? There's one more piece of business I'd like to try to cover today. So, and we will have Senate Bill 118 back in front of us again in the future. But Senator Myers has his hand back up again.
Thank you. I just kind of wanted to continue this just a little bit more. I understand that the differences with the military bases, and there's a possibility of having alternate IDs such as a passport that's federally issued instead. But what about, for example, airlines? If I showed up at the airport and wanted to use my non-real ID and they wouldn't recognize it and I didn't have another one, I mean, what am I doing? Am I calling the troopers and asking them to enforce what the legislature has said with as far as the nullification? How does this work?
And through the chair, I think that is going down an important line of thinking where when there's conflict between what corporations are trying to implement and what the state statute is, I think state statute trumps. I think we are the legislature. We should support, you know, our legislature and legislative supremacy. I think there's been a tremendous amount, even with COVID going on right now. Are we going to let corporations set laws, or are we going to be a legislature and set the law? So, and the supreme law of the land is the Constitution. And I haven't had a chance to, because I had a dental appointment, unexpectedly, I never did an opening statement for myself in regards to this, but I would like to go roundabout back to the Article 6 and Article 10 just to get that on the record today, since you brought it up, Mr. Chairman, if you would allow me to do that.
I'm sorry, Senator Ryan, but we're going to have more time for this, but there's one more piece of business I want to try to get done today. And with that, Senator Myers, did you have anything else?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you. I apologize, Senator Reinbold. It's I don't believe we're going to get those answers answered in the next 7 minutes either. So we will be having Senate Bill 118 back before the committee. All right. So at this time, I will set Senate Bill 118 aside. And the last item on today's calendar is Senate Bill 31 relating to binding caucuses. I will now bring Senate Bill 31 back for the committee. This is the third hearing on Senate Bill 31 and Senate Judiciary. This bill was previously heard on May 10th, 2021, and February 2nd, 2022. During the last hearing, there were a few questions that were raised. I have Jerry Anderson from Legislative Ethics and Noah Klein from Legal Services to answer questions. Does the committee have any further questions on Senate Bill 31?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Schauer.
As we discussed before, I would like to, one, offer, like I said, to committee members who had questions on it. If they have amendments, I'd like to work with them, and we can figure out what might work to make it more clarity in the language and assuage any concerns they had. As Senator Keel asked one, for example, that said, well, you know, would this apply to other things? The reality is it never has. It was only the budget and floor procedures or procedural motions. So if there's amendments, I would like to work with them, but there were questions, like I said, and I defer if they would like to ask them of the legal opinions, and I might be able to add to that as we go through it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Schauer. Is there anything else from the committee on this, including Senator Myers? Do you have any comments? The only reason I ask you is because out of sight, out of mind sometimes, and I tend to not go to the Zoom caller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My only concern, I think it was brought up in the last meeting, is just the issue of enforcement, and I would hope that Mr. Anderson would be able to help us illuminate that a little bit.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Schauer.
Thank you. As we go to Jerry Anderson to ask that question, I would like to provide just a little context because this came up in discussion. As Jerry thinks about the answer, one of the reasons we presented this bill is because as you look at things that happen in Mason's Manual and the uniform rules or in statute, we cannot find anything. As the question was brought up, well, why don't we, you know, do X, Y, Z? And I said, well, you know, I gave the example of, well, let's outlaw murder, because we have, but it doesn't work because we can't legislate behavior. I acknowledge that. But what we found in this process is that when somebody is physically harmed, as my staff had actually paid, deducted for them by a legislative leadership person, we found no recourse because we can't find anything. And the whole point is to put something, the goal is to put something in documentation somewhere that would allow recourse for a equal legislative member to do something, to have that recourse for their staff or themselves if they are somehow coerced, bullied, things are taken from them, the quid pro quo, all the things we mentioned. So I just asked that in context that he considers that, that the goal is to find something somewhere to give us recourse, not have the answer say, well, sorry, there's nothing written, so too bad. Thank you.
Jerry Anderson, if you can hear me, if you have any comments on enforcing Senate Bill 31, enforcement of Senate Bill 31, please state your name, put yourself on the record.
For the record, this is Jerry Anderson. I'm the administrator for the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. And I have only very general comments regarding this particular bill. I do not see anything different than our regular process for filing a complaint in terms of enforcement of it, and that being under our AS 2460-170. Largely, the caucus process is silent in Legislative Ethics Act, that being a creature largely, from what I can determine, a product of just precedent set through the legislature process.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Just a comment,
Senator Schauer.
So in comment or to that, Jerry, and for the committee, Mr. Chairman, when you read statute, and I'm going to quote this one off of memory, and it's close, but it's not going to be correct. It says very clearly that a person cannot be, and we're speaking to an elected official, cannot be compelled to vote for something that they are not required, you know, have to vote for, and they cannot be prevented from voting for something that they don't want to vote for, in essence, like that. It basically says the right statute like a Class B felony. However, we know under a binding caucus that has happened to individuals. They have been threatened with direct action that impacts them, their staff, and their district when they don't vote the way they were told to vote, et cetera. So I understand what he's saying about that and the ethics side of things, but realize that in our statute already it talks about it, but nobody wants to touch that. Oh, that would be too hard. We would do these things. But that's I've experienced it myself. It has happened here. I won't buy the answer that there's nothing that can be done to at least put consequences to that type of behavior, because it is in statute. If a civilian does it, they can go to jail. If a legislator does it, it's okay. And that's not an acceptable answer. So, and that's not on Jerry's shoulders. I just have responded to that. I know Senator Hughes had a question. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. I don't know if Mr. Anderson had any comment on that. Feel free not to. I already have two more senators lining up with more questions.
This is Jerry Anderson, the administrator for the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. I don't have no further comment.
All right. Thank you. Senator Hughes.
Yes, and I know we're up against the time, so I don't know what you're – because I do have several questions, and are we going to have an opportunity to discuss this again, or are we setting the amendment deadline? We have to have our questions answered now.
How many questions do you have?
Well,
I mean,
several. One of them I can just tell them, and then you can estimate. One of them I want to know, because I know when we – if you violate the ethics law, there are penalties that are sometimes and I don't know if they're sometimes financial or the legislator has to perform certain things or certain things happen. So I want to understand, because this is under the ethics law. But then the second question is for the sponsor to discuss. We're not talking here about bribing or you know, being bribed or bribing someone else in exchange for a perk, and that would fall under the criminal law. And so I'm just wondering why the sponsor didn't go, you know, also include that, because the way that the bill is written, it simply is you may not commit your vote. But what about in exchange for a perk, you know, somebody offering you a perk or you accepting a perk, that reaches another level and that ties into criminal law, and we're not touching that here. So I just feel like I don't have enough information to know about what.
Senator Hughes, you have answered your own question. We're going to. I'm not going to set a amendment deadline today. We'll go to Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A little bit along the lines of Senator Hughes's question, if we pass this bill as is the enforcement mechanism currently just an ethics violation, an ethics complaint, or to Senator Schauer's point, you know, where it would be a felony if a regular person tried to do something like this, did we want to explicitly state it in there that we wanted this to be a felony?
Senator Schauer?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I can answer both very quickly. Senator Hughes' question, the reason we didn't do that is because when we discussed this with different legislators, there was such an abhorrent reaction to, oh, my God, a felony, what would happen? And there was like this natural, like, just resistance, don't want to go there. We're trying to make it something that at least gets something on paper that provides a consequential action for that type of behavior. And when you included felony and other stuff, you can see people just melting into the woodwork. They're like, okay, so that may not be politically a path I want to pursue because it'd be hard to even get a hearing on it because people seem to be so against it. So that is a partial answer to Senator Hughes' question, to Senator Myers' question. We could do that now. We could have this in here so there's consequences. But, I mean, let's be frank. The Vigo scandal, other things come to mind. People were bribed, and they went to jail, and they were prosecuted. So this could easily, if somebody did something that went beyond just an ethics violation for, you know, bad behavior or, you know, like what has happened to Senator Hughes and myself before in the last few years, you could always up it. There's nothing that would prevent you from filing that if that was to happen to you. But this is more of an effort, Mr. Chairman, I think, really just to get something on the books so that we have some recourse, we can discuss this, and there's something to hang your hat on. Because the answer so far I go back to circle back, has been, well, there's nothing there. So if there's nothing there, there's nothing to see, therefore nobody did anything wrong. And we know that's not the case. So how do I'm open to options to get there. I don't know how else to do it other than perhaps this as an option. Anyways, that's the best I can do for now.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question for Mr. Anderson, and I want to be a little bit literalist here about the text in the bill. The bill carves out an exception for certain votes or informal polls in a caucus. But does it, as written, apply to the formation of a caucus, a majority or a minority, right? Because I am not a member of the majority, and so I have fewer staff. I have fewer points to pay each staff member. I do not control a gavel. These are the things that the sponsor has described as the forbidden binding mechanisms. So is this subject to the interpretation that it would apply to the formation of a caucus in the first place?
Mr. Anderson?
Senator Keel, the definitions that are used in this bill are taken from the open meetings guidelines, and in that it talks about what is covered under open meetings as part of caucus procedures, and some of those are in it and some of them are not. For example, political strategy is not part of the open meetings guidelines. And so that is the context of where these are picked up from the Legislative Ethics Act. But the actual use of that without any more language on it pulls it into only that definition. And of course, that definition of a caucus, I can flip to real quickly, and it just means a group of legislators who share a political philosophy or have a common goal or who organize as a group, the common definition that I think all of us have for a caucus. And so if it met that definition, the committee would be looking at that and looking at someone who is trying to bind them based on the new language in the offered bill. And so then again, it goes through, if it did, it went through a complaint process. And in that complaint process, it has specific sanctions that can be imposed as part of the complaint process if the committee did find a violation and it went through that way. And I hope that answered your question with regard to that. just in a general sense. And I could also just defer to Noah Klein for further on that.
Noah Klein, do you have any input on this, if you place yourself on the record?
To the chair, this is Noah Klein, Legislative Legal Services. I'm sorry, Senator Steele, would you be willing to repeat this question? I could offer my opinion.
I could. You think you could offer a brief repetition? We will be discussing this again next week if you...
I'll do my very best, and if Legal Services wants to follow up subsequently, that's fine. The question was whether the bill is susceptible to a reading by the Ethics Committee that it applies to the formation of a caucus, of majority and minority caucuses, because that has the consequences that the sponsor has described as being the binding mechanisms used and subject to this ethics law. So, you know, fewer staff, fewer pay range points for those staff, control of a gavel or not, those things. So that's the inquiry and whether the Ethics Committee might read it that way. Thank you.
Mr. Klein.
Through the chair, this is Noah Klein, Legislative Legal Services, to Senator Keel. If I understand your question correctly, yes, I do think the bill could apply to the formation. Again, it all would come down to, right, it's going to be the Ethics Committee that is interpreting this language ultimately, but could it be susceptible to that interpretation? Yes, the formation of a caucus, if legislators were committing to vote for or against the bill, appointment, veto, or any other measure that may come to a vote, if that was occurring during the formation, that wouldn't be subject to the exception in paragraph one.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. At this point, I'm planning to set this bill aside for further work. I think we still have some more issues to resolve on it. Thank you, Mr. Klein. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. So we will now set Senate Bill 31 aside. Under other business, at this time, I'm going to set an amendment deadline for Senate Bill 7, which is a bill sponsored by Senator Ray Jackson regarding Department of Public Safety notification procedures. Please submit amendments to my office by noon on Tuesday, February 15th. And is there any other business before the committee? Seeing none, our next meeting is Monday, February 14th at 1:30 p.m. We're adjourned a little late at 3:08 p.m.